Good morning. How was the party? Everybody have fun? Did everybody have fun? Okay.
Not as much fun as we're going to have now.
Excellent. Okay. My name is Bob Combs, and I've got with me Jose Barreto, and we're going to talk about two different topics, actually, NIC teaming and SMB multi-channel. And you might ask yourself, well, why are we doing it that way? Well, I guess because from a networking and a storage perspective, it's all about reliability. So I'm from the networking team, and I'm going to talk about the NIC teaming part first. We'll give you an overview of NIC teaming. We'll talk about some of the configuration choices, when to use them, when not to use them. And then we'll do a little demo about managing NIC teaming, and we'll talk a little bit about some of the variations of that as well. Jose will get up, and he'll talk about the SMB side of it. He'll give you a really good overview, talk about some sample configurations, and how one goes about diagnosing problems. And he's got some demos for you, too. So, what do these things have in common? Well, the first thing, of course, is reliability. Teaming provides the failover for the networking on the host side, and it makes sure that your failover architecture has a consistent networking connection for you. SMB multipath provides the multipath protections that give you the same reliability on the storage side. So the other thing, of course, that we get out of teaming and SMB is we get more bandwidth. More bandwidth, of course, is always good. They do it in slightly different ways, but the net result is effectively the same. And teaming and multi-channel work together. And Jose will get into that a little deeper. All right. No talk at TechEd would be complete without this slide. Well, this slide is effectively our pillars for 2012. So where we are, of course, is on the NIC teaming side. We're talking about beyond virtualization, although, in fact, teaming can be used without virtualization. That is a standalone host. And on the power of many servers, the simplicity of one theme, SMB multi-channel. Okay, so let's dive into NIC teaming. What is NIC teaming? Well, NIC teaming is also known as load balancing failover. It's known as NIC bonding. It's known as link aggregation groups. It's known as ether channel. Depends on, you know, whose proprietary or generic teaming solution you've got. How many of you are using teaming in your systems today? Just about everybody. Okay. Very good. And I'm assuming, let's see, how can I ask this? How many, you know, for example, how many of you are using, say, an HP teaming solution? And how many are using, say, an Intel teaming solution? And how many might be using a Broadcom teaming solution? And how many might be using, geez, I don't know, doesn't matter. They're all different. And how many are frustrated with the fact that if you use more than one, that the management interface is different for each? Just about right, yeah. By the way, most of the manufacturers, you know, the IHVs for the NICs or the OEMs came to Microsoft at one point or another in the past and have said, gee, guys, why don't you support teaming? It'd be really nice if you did it and we didn't have to worry about it quite so much. So, teaming is basically combining two or more adapters so that you have a team so they can fail over. It gives you a combination of things. You can aggregate the bandwidth, or you can do just failover, or you can do both. And in fact, the solution that we've come up with for 2012 actually does, in fact, provide you both, as you would expect. The other thing that teaming can provide is it can provide a split out for VLAN interfaces. That is, I might have a team of a couple of NICs, and I might want to be able to separate out, you know, VLAN 10 and VLAN 20, VLAN 100, and use these as separate connections, if you will, inside the host. So that's another thing it can provide for you. So what did we do when we put it together? We did a couple of things. First, we want to make sure that it was vendor agnostic. Essentially, anybody's NIC, as long as it's got a Microsoft Windows logo certification, will work in our teams. It's fully integrated. That is, it's a base part of the OS. It's not some extra product or anything, so it's always there. We made sure that the interface, the UI, that is integrated. You can kick it off from the server manager. You can also configure it using PowerShell. And it's essentially the same regardless of what's underneath. It's a Microsoft-supported team, so that's going to save you in the issues when you try and assign blame to when things are going wrong. You'll be able to go to the Microsoft support and ask, you know, what's going on with my team? And nobody's going to tell you, oh, gee, you know, I'm Microsoft support, you called up and it's a third party, turn that off and let's see if that works. That's not what they're going to tell you anymore. So that's a good thing, yes? All right, let's talk a little bit about the dialogue, that is the names that we use for some of these things. The team itself we refer to often as a teaming driver. You'll sometimes hear about a teaming provider, but that's essentially the central core. It is, in fact, a networking multiplexing filter. The interface on the top of it, and there could be one or more, we refer to as team interfaces, team NICs. You'll probably hear me more commonly refer to it as a TNIC, team NIC. On the bottom, of course, are the team members or the network adapters. All of these can be exposed in the system as network interfaces. I have no idea why it did that. Just out of curiosity. Nope. Okay. Okay. It shouldn't do that, but it did. There are a couple of different modes for teams. One is obviously switched independent, meaning the team doesn't really know about the switch, doesn't need to know about the switch. He's doing his work totally within the team multiplexer himself. He can be protecting against switch failures, but he's doing it all inside his own software. The other is obviously switch dependent, where you actually have to configure something on the switch itself. More commonly, you might call it LACP, 802.1AX, used to be called 802.3AD. There's a fairly common switch protocol which lets some automatic failover happen between the NIC and the switch when a connection goes down or is disabled, etc. Just out of curiosity, how many of you are using switch-dependent mode today? Okay, fair number. Okay. Interesting point. The most common failure that we hear from people is that the human screwed up. Either somebody did something funky to the switch configuration, somebody decided that, you know, a cable needed to be rerouted and moved it, or something. We're not really hearing too much about hardware failures these days. Is that fairly consistent with what you're hearing? Yeah? Beg your pardon? Or if you do not include drivers. Okay, yeah. That's... we have several algorithms for doing the load distribution. One is address hash. The other is the Hyper-V port. Within the address hash, there's actually multiple ways in which the address hash can be done. By default, it will attempt to do the four-tuple hash. If it can't do the four-tuple hash, it will drop down to a two-tuple hash. If it can't do a two-tuple hash, it'll drop down to a MAC address hash. You can set the mode, but if you leave it in default, it'll try and pick the correct one. Obviously, if you're using certain forms of traffic that aren't IP traffic, it will end up in the MAC address hash. The Hyper-V port is actually using the port number on the virtual switch itself as part of the hash. And there are some benefits for some of that. So let's talk about some of these. So you'll notice that this nice little table summarizes the different modes for configuration. We have a switch independent row, a switch dependent row. We have an address hash column and a Hyper-V port column. And let's kind of go through each of these in a little bit more. I guess we'll go through it in a minute. You can tell what mode that your switch is in if you go to the NIC teaming interface, lbfoadmin.exe. You can also get to it, and I'll show you in a demo where it is. But you'll notice that if I go ahead and select this team over there on the left-hand side, and if you pull up its properties, you know, right-click properties, you'll get what's over on the right-hand side, NIC teaming. And if you click on the additional properties, it'll, of course, show you whether or not, what the teaming mode is, what the load balancing mode is, and what the whether the adapters are using active-active or active-standby. You can also get the same information using PowerShell by using the get net LBFO team. And you'll notice there that there's a teaming mode down a fourth line down, load balancing algorithm. Transport ports means address hash, and the current status of the team overall. Okay, back to the table. So, first one we'll talk about is switch independent address hash. Switch independent address hash. Let's see what I want to really tell you here. So this is the mode that you would typically use if you're not on Hyper-V and you're teaming NICs. In other words, I've just got a generic host. It's also the mode that you would want to use if you're doing teaming in the guest. And the only real use case I can think of for where you would want to do that is if you're doing SRIOV. We do not support teaming in the host with SRIOV interfaces, because SRIOV interfaces tend to bypass the virtual switch, so that that would affect the ability for the team to balance. So what we do instead is we allow the teaming in the guest. So if you set up two separate virtual switches and then had those actually have each an SRIOV interface in the guest, then you could put the team in the guest itself. Obviously, that's going to be a switch independent, and you're going to use address hash because you don't have Hyper-V ports in the guest. And if you tried to use some kind of a switch dependent, you would actually confuse the physical switch on the outside. The sweet spot probably for switch independent is actually using the Hyper-V ports. So this is the mode you would most normally want to use for it. It has some advantages here in the sense that it tends to send the traffic on multiple NICs and lets you do use of VMQ, virtual machine queues, for your overall performance. It's best used when the number of VMs exceeds the number of team members. And there's one point here is a restriction of a VM to one NIC's bandwidth. By that I mean if I have a connection and that connection is going to exceed the bandwidth of an individual NIC, then that's going to be problematic. Because then if you try to do a failover, it's not going to be able to guarantee the same bandwidth. On the switch dependent side, a couple of interesting things here. This is probably the sweet spot for switch dependency. I say that because in this case, you're actually using the hashing and you can now distribute the loads. You can now have connections that exceed an individual NIC's bandwidth because you're actually sharing the total pipe. So I'm going to tell you here. Okay, yep, defaults to four tuple hash. It's probably where you want to start from anyway. It will automatically drop down, as we said, anyway. So this is, so if you're doing a switch dependent, you probably want to be using address hash. There are some cases where you might want to, with switch dependency, use the Hyper-V port. But this is really when the VMs on the switch are exceeding the number of team members. And when you really don't need to use LACP. Note that you have the same, you have the additional restriction that you can't exceed an individual NIC's bandwidth. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the team interfaces themselves. The default mode, of course, means that all the traffic is being coming up through the TNIC. And in this, and in Hyper-V, where you can only use, or you should only use, one TNIC, the default TNIC. That is really the only configuration that Microsoft will support for Hyper-V. If you're using non-Hyper-V, you can go ahead and set up additional VLAN TNIC interfaces. And as you see over on the left-hand side, here's one where you set up a VLAN 42, and you have a default, which means it gives everybody else but 42. That should give you a clue as to why the one on the right isn't supported. It will be problematic. If you set up an additional TNIC of, say, VLAN 42 over on the right-hand Hyper-V, and then you at some point create a VM that's on VM 42, you'll be very confused as to why it's not getting any traffic at all. And it'll be because the team is sending the traffic off to the other TNIC. So that's one of the reasons why you really don't want to do it. You really don't want to support additional TNIC interfaces if you're in Hyper-V. The other thing to note is that if you don't create a default mode, that is, if you assign TNICs only with VLANs, then what's going to happen is that any additional traffic will be tossed away and dropped. Something to watch out for if you're configuring your hosts individually. By default, when you create the team, it will have a single team TNIC interface, and it will be in the default mode. It also is given a name by default, which takes the name and kind of decorates it. You can still go back and use the rename NetAdapter commandlet if you want to name it to something more specific of your own choosing. The get NetAdapter commandlet will show you all of the NICs in the system, all the virtual NICs as well. And so the TNICs will actually show up because they, even though they're a virtual NIC, it will show up in the get NetAdapter list. So here's an example on the lower right-hand corner of the get NetAdapter showing all the NICs in the system. And you'll notice that there is a team there, team one, actually showing up twice, so it's got two TNIC interfaces. If you create additional TNICs after you've initially created the team, then those TNICs have to be assigned to a VLAN specifically. Tell you here that you can create the interfaces with either the UI or you can create them with the PowerShell back and forth. It doesn't matter. They'll refresh each other. And again, the caveat that for Hyper-V, only the default TNIC is supported. One of the questions that has come up a couple of times in both beta and in RC and TAP programs has been, why would I really want to create a team of one? Well, the answer is you might want to do that to actually separate out the traffic by the different VLANs. Obviously, a team of one doesn't have any protection against failure. The other thing is it's quite often that people will create a team of one and then add NICs as they start to expand their system out. Sorry. Yeah, your question?
How many VLANs
You're asking how many NICs can be in a team?
Yeah,
32. Yeah, there can be 32 NICs in a team. I'll actually get to that. We do have a slide on kind of the parameters. So I've already mentioned that teams have to be can have any logoed certified adapters, but they can only be Ethernet adapters. There is no support for teaming of any other type, be it InfiniBand, Wi-Fi, etc. And team of teams is also something that's not currently supported. Do you know what team of teams are? Yes? No? So a team of teams would mean something where within the team I have sub-teams, actually. And the sub-teams might be something like, say, a couple of 1-gig interfaces that maybe I've teamed together, I use as a management interface, maybe a couple of 10 gigs that I'm that sub-team being used for virtual machine traffic and the like. And that would be considered a team of teams. That we don't specifically support. Question? We don't support team of teams. So. Correct. Okay. So the comment is that there's not a use case for team of teams. That's not totally strictly true. You could actually go ahead. The way we support it, you actually can create multiple different teams. It turns out that there are a few use cases where, and the one that comes to mind is the Cisco Nexus 1000V extension will actually utilize its team of NICs in team of teams. We provide enough APIs internally that extensions can actually do this if they wish, even though we don't, out of the box, have that functionality supported. So what they're actually doing, if you think about it, they can do exactly kind of the scenario I said, where I might have a couple of 1-gig NICs that are teamed together that are used for management, a couple of 1-gig NICs that are teamed together that are used for live migration, maybe a couple of NICs that are ganged together that are used for some kind of storage, and then a couple more NICs that would be teamed together that would be used for the VM traffic. And then all of those are all in the same team managed by the same switch. So that's the use case anyway. Okay, so I think I mentioned briefly before that teams can have team members that are either active or standby. If you're using active standby, you don't have to. In fact, for my thinking, I would probably always want everything to be active. But there might be cases where, for whatever reason, that you actually, don't want to have that big a pipe at one point, but you do want to have the failover capability. In that case, if I'm not actually aggregating bandwidth or doing a balancing, at least I can actually do failover. And so active standby is supported. I did mention this before, that teaming can be supported in the guest, and as I gave you, as I mentioned before, SRIOV is probably the more common use case for where you really want to do this. There is one caveat I should tell you about. In order to make it work, you have to go into the net adapters, the VM network adapter, that is the ports for on the Hyper-V switch for each of these synthetic NICs. And you have to set a flag. There's a checkbox, as it turns out, called allow teaming. You have to have allow teaming on both of these set in order for them to understand that that's the mode that they're being put into. Say again? As I said before, this is only a switch-independent configuration. If you try to use switch-dependent from the guests, you pose a problem of confusing the switch. Right, because there can be, because in this case with SRIOV, you're talking about having multiple different sets of connections that potentially go to it. I'm not quite sure I grasp the question yet. And, okay, so in this particular team where you're talking SRIOV, so the question you're asking is how do two different VMs who each have their own teams, how are they actually talking to each other? It depends on what mode each one is in. For example, if they're both currently using SRIOV, then they will actually talk to each other through the switch, through the NICs embedded switch, not through the virtual switch. If one of them is in the software path, that is, he's not using SRIOV currently, then the communication will down through the team will go down through that particular Hyper-V switch, and it'll go loop back around into the NIC of the other one. Or talk over the same software path if they're both connected to the same virtual switch. You're asking if you can use full bandwidth between two virtual machines. Yes, you can, and you don't need teaming for that. I think the thing you're tripping across here is that when you look at the speed of a virtual machine, that it says that its speed is 10 gig, it's lying to you. There is no limitation. It's only how fast the system will actually go. They had, you know, when Hyper-V was built, they had to pick something, and at that time, 10 gig was kind of the ceiling. So they said, okay, 10 gig. But in fact, it'll actually go at whatever speed it is because it's just software to software. Yeah. Okay, manageability. So we got a nice, simple interface, we think. We like it. We've gotten really good feedback on it. And I'll show you the UI in a second. However, it's good to also note that you can do everything that you can do in the UI, you can do with the PowerShell commandlets as well. So there's NetLBFO team, team NIC, team member. Team means the team overall. The team NIC is actually referring to the TNICs on the top, and the team members are actually the physical network adapters along the bottom. This guy? Mm-hmm. Okay. Cool. Thanks, Jose. I get to demo on Jose's demo machine. I won't screw your machine up, Jose, I promise. So, if you bring up Server Manager and you look at the local server, you'll notice that there's a NIC teaming here. What was that again? There we go. That's what I wanted to do. Okay. So, NIC teaming, notice that it says disabled. And if I actually go and click on that, it then will launch lbfoadmin.exe, which is built in the same UI framework as the server manager itself is. And within this, you'll notice we've got some NICs here, a couple of 10 gigs. It won't let me select at the same time. Well, that's a problem. Okay, so I've got a couple of 10 gigs here that I'm going to select. Just so you know, this is not how we're remote desktoping in. So, and I can say, yep, let's make a new team. I said, okay, well, what would you like to call the team? Oh, let's call it TechEd. And I can also look at some additional properties and say, yeah, switch independent's good. I like hash. You know, I think I'm going to select a standby adapter. And it goes ahead. In fact, it's created that team. If we now look at the properties of the team, you'll notice that one is in standby, one is active. And I can actually go ahead and let's see, where do I do this? if I go back and tell it to, actually, let me do it this way. I'm going to disable the active one, and you'll notice that it flipped over and it went active on the standby went into active mode. And if it's enabled, it'll go ahead and flip it. Pardon? Can I disable the fallback? I don't know. That's a good question. I'm not sure. Yeah. Not as far as I know. The other thing I wanted to show you, do we have PowerShell up? Nope. That's one of your VMs. There's PowerShell. Okay. So I should be able to... Yep, I can find the team. Cool. Okay. So let's say I want to get rid of it. See, it's deleted the team. And as soon as this thing refreshes, I should see. Where's refresh? Oh, the heck with it. Pardon? Ah, there we go. There we go. You can see I use PowerShell a lot more than I use this. One more warning messages. There we go. And in fact, it now shows as disabled again. Okay. Let me go back here. So a couple other things that I want to tell you about with Teams. Teams actually interact with and support the additional offload features that we've got, things like RSS, VMQ, IPsec task offload, large send offload, jumbo frames, all the checksums, receive segment coalescing, its checksums, DCB, and network virtualization, a new feature that we were introducing in 2012. A couple of caveats, SRIOV, only in the guest, and things that do that aren't supported are RDMA and the TCP chimney offloads. So those you can't do through. And as it turns out, I don't know if you're aware of this, but we in Server 2008 R2, we had supported TCP chimney offload for virtual machines. We have removed that in 2012. As it turns out that with having LSO and RSC and some of the other performance enhancements, the TCP chimney offload wasn't buying enough to make it worth the additional work. Okay, so this is kind of to the question you asked earlier. Maximum number of NICs in a team can be 32. Maximum number of team interfaces off the, that is TNICs, can be 32. Maximum number of teams in a server are 32. Just to let you know, these are not hard limits. These are supported limits. You could probably put 64 NICs on a team. I don't know why you'd need that many or where you'd get them or where you'd find a box big enough to put them all in. But you could do it, but we only support 32. 32 on all these limits. Okay. We did this already, so I'm going to skip right over here and hand it over to Jose.
All right.
Thank you.
Am I on? Question. Bob?
Yeah, sure. I see what you're asking. Okay, so basically your question is, if I had four NICs, Before, with Hyper-V, I would use each of them for, you know, live migration, management, VMs. And now if I put it in one big team, is that still a yeah. The recommendations do change a little bit, yeah. What's happening is most of the OEMs are beginning to ship blades and whatnot that have 210-gig NICs on board. And you can take those 210-gig NICs now, team them, separate out your individual interfaces. Remember, though, that what we were saying is that we're not supporting this configuration for Hyper-V. So what that, in other words, you want... Let me finish. So effectively what you do is you would want to have at least four NICs in your system, and you'd use two of them teamed for your Hyper-V. You'd then team the others and do the VLAN separations off of them for all those additional surfaces. This way you get full redundancy of all your connections.
Well, the exception is the VLAN interaction, right? When you have VLANs and Hyper-V in the same one, you don't want to pull off a VLAN out of the team before you wire to the VM switch, because that becomes a black hole. And then you forget that you did that, and then at some point you will have a really horrible time troubleshooting that thing, because anything you send to that VLAN doesn't get to the switch because it's wired off to this place that goes nowhere.
Yes, there is documentation on best practices that are being put together now. Those should be out shortly, I assume.
Okay. Cool.
Thank you.
Sure, go for it.
That's an interesting question. So if you use any of the techniques that actually split the NIC into multiple interfaces, the caveat here should be that you don't really want to build a team of those, because you're not getting any real redundancy, you're not getting any real aggregation. So, how you could use NPAR or any of those kind of things is you could actually separate it out into, say, four NICs, and you could take one of them and then one from another NIC and actually make that team for your virtual machines. So you could then use some of the other unused NIC partitions for things like live migration and such, yeah. That would work.
But you do have to understand that, you know, there are, say, two physical, each split in two, and then you're going to mix the flags on each one, so you don't kind of create a redundancy. You think you're doing redundancy, but you're really not.
Yeah, right? that's actually a pretty good solution.
All right, let's talk multi-channel. And the important thing here is that folks come to me and say, oh, there's NIC teaming, so why do we even have multi-channel, right? And if you haven't seen it, what is multi-channel? Multi-channel is the ability for SMB to actually use multiple TCP connections at the same time. And typically, you would think about it in the context of teaming. So say, for instance, most common case is that sample configuration here where you have the multiple 1 gig. So if I have two 1 gig NICs on the client and the server, and I'm doing an SMB connection, I effectively use both 1 gig NICs at the same time, and I get 2 gigs throughput, right? And if one of the two 1 gig NICs fails, you're down to 1 gig, but it's completely transparent. SMB will use the path that's remaining. And not only that, but if the 1 gig that was lost or misconfigured or unplugged comes back, multi-channel will automatically, within seconds, bring that second NIC back into play, and you have 2 gig throughput again. And say, well, that looks a lot like teaming. The only difference here is in multi-channel, what you would do is you keep the two NICs configured, each with their own IP addresses, and SMB understands that and uses them both at the same time by putting one TCP connection on one leg and the one TCP connection on the other leg. If that was the only thing to it, yes, then it would be redundant and probably not a good idea in the first place, because SMB multi-channel only works for SMB. So if you're doing management of this box, the management infrastructure doesn't use SMB, so you're not going to actually have redundancy or aggregation for the management traffic. If you're doing live migration, you don't have the same kind of awareness. Storage migration, yes, if it's using SMB, it would be using multi-channel. But if you're using iSCSI, it wouldn't do anything for you. So that's why we have teaming. Teaming is a generic solution that works for all kinds of TCP traffic because it happens at a lower layer, right? Now, we did do multi-channel because that's not the only use case. For instance, think about the single 10 gig NIC case. So today, if you have a single 1 gig NIC, there's nothing about redundancy there, but there is when you're doing very small I/O on that 10 gig NIC. Let's say you're doing lots and lots of 1K reads and writes. What's going to happen there is that your CPU is going to be very busy handling all that traffic going down the TCP/IP stack, and it just so happens that the way TCP/IP in Windows works is that a single connection will affinitize with one of the cores in the machine. So in order to actually leverage multiple cores at the same time, it would be great if we could have multiple TCP connections. Now, if you look at this, it doesn't really make much sense at first because, oh, if I'm talking from this server to that server, it's IP address 10.1.1.1 to 10.1.1.2, then why would I create multiple TCP connections anyway? Well, to give the stack the opportunity to do more about it. So what we do when we detect this situation is now SMB 3.0 automatically, without you doing anything, you talk to the other side, you figure out that, oh, interesting, this configuration supports something called receive side scaling. And both sides are SMB 3.0, so they understand multi-channel. So SMB will naturally, automatically, after the first connection is created, add three more connections. And you can see that if you're doing netmon or if you just do a netstat, all the tools you see, oh, there are four TCP connections. But I'm only doing one file transfer between these boxes. Why is that happening? That is SMB multi-channel. There are always other reasons. And I want to make sure you understand, if you have teaming, it is okay. In fact, it is recommended that you team first, and then multi-channel will go on top, recognize that situation, and put more connections there. Why? Because in certain modes, so which mode, let's see if you're paying attention to Bob, right? In which mode would I actually, if I have 2 1 gigs in a team, right, and I want to put multi-channel on top, I want to actually get 2 gig throughput. How do I do it? First of all, it has to be active-active. That's a good point. If you have a standby there, that's not going to happen. The other thing, which mode do you want to do? Dependent or independent? I'll let you think about that one. We'll come back to it, okay? But yes, only you need to understand your teaming, because if the teaming is not configured properly, then SMB will create the multiple connections, but they won't effectively give you the added throughput. There will be a test at the end. And then there's RDMA, right? One of the things that Bob mentioned is that it won't team RDMA interfaces, right? Actually, you can team Ethernet-based RDMA, but then the team doesn't have the RDMA capability. We'll get more to that. But I'm sure if you pay attention, this machine that Bob was using as a demo has 2 InfiniBand adapters. But when you went to the teaming interface, they didn't show up. Did you notice that? Why is that? The same reason why the wireless won't show up. There are certain types of NICs that can be teamed, certain that can't, right? So keep that in mind. But we, in multi-channel, we offer the ability to have the aggregation and the network fault tolerance for RDMA interfaces. And it just so happens that in this release, SMB is the only consumer of the RDMA capability in Windows provided by the networking team, okay? So let's talk a little bit about each one individually. So the reason why you do this is, again, throughput and fault tolerance, right? So you want to aggregate the bandwidth and you want to survive the failure of a single NIC. And SMB multi-channel throws in automatic configuration. So unlike teaming, you don't need to set it up to make it work, right? So we kind of discover the configuration or do it. And the only reason why we do this is because we work at a level, at the application level, we can kind of understand more about the two sides. That's another difference between teaming and multi-channel. Teaming is always thinking, oh, here I have my interfaces, and that's what I'm going to do. SMB multi-channel actually talks to the other side, asks what's happening there, and makes a decision based on both sides. Okay? So there's, say again? It discovers all kinds of fun things like subnets. We don't really take VLANs into consideration. We think IP addresses and subnets. But I'll show you a few things in the demo to kind of put you in the right mindset to troubleshoot SMB multi-channel, which is probably the most fun thing that you will get out of this. And I encourage you to do it. So first case here is the 10 gig NIC, right? The case of the single 10 gig NIC, you're using SMB2. And when you do SMB2, you create one single TCP connection. That TCP connection will naturally affinitize with one of the cores. And if you learn anything about performance these days, is that machines are getting more cores, but the individual cores are not really that much faster, right? Have you noticed that? The speeds of the cores is actually remaining. You get more of them. So in this case, let's imagine you have Hyper-V over SMB or SQL over SMB, and that single client is trying to jam all that traffic to the other side. They're trying to do gigabytes a second on small I/O, and everything is going to a single core. What's going to happen? Well, you're going to bottleneck on that core, and you're not going to go any faster, not because you don't have the bandwidth. If you look at your CPU utilization as a whole, you're going to be at 25%. And you say, interesting, exactly 25%. Why is that, right? And then when you go deeper, you see, oh, let me look by core. Hey, look, this guy's pegged, right? What you want to do is you want to enable multi-channel. So if you're using SMB 3.0, and by the way, I did mention that this feature is being implemented by third parties as well, right? So this is not Windows talking to Windows. This is SMB 3.0 talking to SMB 3.0. It's a very important notion there. But what you get is now one session, one file copy. It could be a single VHD you're copying from point A to point B. If you are using SMB 3.0 on both sides, we will create multiple connections naturally. And you're going to see multiple cores engaged. In fact, this is configurable. We default to 4. Jose, why 4? Because 3 were too few and 5 were too many, right? Essentially. No, we actually had to pick a number, right? We had all kinds of discussions, number of cores in the machine, number of, you know, RSS queues in the NIC. There are all kinds of discussions we had about this, and it turns out that 4 is enough. If you ever find that 4 is not enough, there's a PowerShell command that you can set the number of connections you do, and it will actually do it on the fly. You have 4, you set it to 8, it will bloop, 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 8. Okay? While it's running. That's another thing about multi-channel. Most of the stuff that you do with multi-channel, it will actually happen while things are in motion. It won't actually need to restart, stop the session, restart the session, none of that. For the most part, that's accurate. Yes? That's a great question. There's no good reason to use multiple from the Hyper-V host because they are synthetic NICs and they affinitize in other ways. So, no. The idea is not to do that. What you typically will see is that NICs have RSS capability today almost. I think server NICs, it's mandatory, right, these days that you pass RSS. So the only NICs that won't do that would be like client-grade NICs, right? And we typically try to do this to give the stack the opportunity to to improve it. There's no guarantees, by the way, that you're going to split across the course evenly, as my diagram shows. It is very possible that maybe you end up with two in one core and a few other cores with just one, but at least you have that opportunity. Let's talk about multiple NICs. So I kind of talk about this. So if you don't have multi-channel and you have multiple paths, I actually have a blog post on that that shows how to use multiple NICs on a file server. And in the old days, you would do this. If you have two paths, you use one. We are actually, since two, I'll get to you. We had the ability to do what we call durability, meaning that if you have multiple in SMB2, in Windows Server 2008 R2, and you lose that one, we would switch over to the other one. We actually could do that. There were some limitations. It was kind of tentative. You actually had to have an op lock to make that happen, which usually you did. But now it's much more predictable. What we do now is we establish multiple connections. If the interfaces are capable of doing RSS, we'll do the multiple NICs per interface. And then when you have multiple interfaces, you will actually have that number per interface. So there's an example here of one guy that's RSS capable, so we do four per NIC, and the other guy that's not RSS capable, and then we do one per NIC. There was a question in the back there. No. Question is, do I do down-level port of SMB multi-channel? So if you are using older versions of SMB, they don't understand multi-channel, right? And you say, oh, you just try to, you know, port that feature back to SMB 2. Problem is, first of all, there's a protocol implication. We have to rewrite the protocol to make that happen. Second, what I notice about SMB is that SMB multi-channel connects to SMB Direct, which connects to RSS, which connects to this. So if you pull SMB multi-channel, you bring up the whole stack. So it's like porting Windows Server 2012 entirely back to an old release. Very complicated thing to do. So what we do is we negotiate. So if you have an SMB 3.0 client talking to an SMB 2X or even 1X, we'll negotiate the protocol level and we'll do whatever that other side can do. We do a least common denominator. Okay? That's what we try to do. And by the way, keep in mind, if you're doing this for Hyper-V, Hyper-V actually requires SMB 3.0. So don't use 2.x. Okay. You could ask about performance. I have a white paper that came out when we were still in the developer preview. This white paper is almost like 9 months old now. And what it shows is that doing regular 10 gig, we aggregate pretty well. So what this chart is showing is that we can achieve with one 10 gig, you can, in theory, do about 1.1 gigabytes a second, right? So we did this for two, for three, for four 10 gigs, right? And we aggregate pretty well. What you notice here in the chart is that at that time, up to 32K IOs, we pretty much scale linearly. And then the smaller the IO gets, the harder it gets to get full throughput on that. I think we moved that bar in the release candidate. I think we're doing, you know, the lines go up earlier. And I'll encourage you, who here has a setup with 410 gig NICs on two sides? Go play with it. Just, you know, configure all the NICs, do a file copy, measure it up, see what you see. We're getting very good results. Okay? All right. The other thing is a combination of multi-channel and NIC teaming, right? So what we did, we made a change. Actually, in the beta, we didn't do this, but in the release candidate, we're doing it. When we detect a team, we will always set the RSS capable flag. So if there is a team, even if the team doesn't report RSS capability, we will always use multiple because we know it's a team. And if it's a team, there is an opportunity to actually gain more bandwidth, to do aggregation at a lower level. So the answer to the question is you want to have the switch dependent and you want the four tuple hash, right? Because you want to be able to actually have the team all the way down being able to do aggregation. If you have a switch independent mode, then the traffic that goes out can go out with the four-tuple hash on the multiple interfaces, but the return traffic always comes from one of them, which is the one that got the infrastructure learns the return path, right? So it will actually like one MAC address for the return path. So going out, you actually go through multiple. Coming in, it will come through one, unless you do the switch-dependent one, because then the switch understands and it can actually do it properly. Okay? So before you had multi-channel, you could team, use only one. You would never, say for instance, 2 10 gigs, you would never move any faster than 10 gig. With teaming combined with multi-channel, there is an opportunity that you might get to 20. Is there a guarantee that you get to 20? No, there isn't. There are a few variables that we were discussing here, but there is a possibility that you will if you're doing the right things. And of course, you get the side benefit of engaging the multiple cores there. Jose, I only see 2 connections per 10 gig NIC here. Yes, because we did 4, remember? And I'm being optimistic and imagining that the 4 will be split across the 2 physical NICs, and then you get that. And maybe in that configuration, you might want to tweak this and configure it to do 8 per interface, which is a simple PowerShell. I can show you that. Okay? Let's move here. I want to do a demo. So SMB Direct and multi-channel. So it's an interesting thing. There's a great relationship between multi-channel and SMB Direct. Multi-channel is the one that actually understands capabilities of NICs. So SMB multi-channel is a feature in SMB that actually knows if a NIC is RSS capable, if a NIC is RDMA capable. One thing that happens, if you disable multi-channel, there is no RDMA. Why? Because if you didn't enable multi-channel, you never talk to the other side to understand network capabilities, then you will never engage RDMA at all. Right, so be very careful. When you're disabling multi-channel, which you can, it's simple PowerShell for doing that, you're also disabling RDMA at the same time. It's on by default, by the way. But if you do have it, we start the connection over TCP/IP, every RDMA interface, by definition, through the way that it's implemented with the NDK in Windows, we'll start with a TCP/IP connection. We talk to the other side, say, are you 3.0? Yes, I'm 3.0. Can you give me a list of your interfaces? Oh, RDMA, I prefer that. Then establish RDMA connections. We keep the TCP connection around just in case things fail so that we can quickly fall back to the original TCP, but it's actually not used once we engage the RDMA path, right? In this case, just for fun, I'm doing 2 RDMA NICs, and we do 2 RDMA connections per interface, also configurable. No good reason to do it, actually, but you could. And the reason we do 2 is that most RDMA cards have multiple engines inside of them, so having 2 actually is good for performance. Things that don't work, we don't do multi-channel with multiple wireless interfaces. We don't do it if there is no RSS capability in the NIC, simply because adding more connections there doesn't help. One interesting side effect of multi-channel is that we reevaluate the policy every time a new interface arrives. So there is some side effects of using multi-channel. So for instance, you start a copy over wireless on your laptop to an SMB server. So, of course, in this case, you have to be running Windows 8, which is 3.0. You have to be talking to a Windows 8 server, a Windows Server 2012, I should be saying, or a third-party SMB implementation that implements 3.0 and has a multi-channel capability. You start this over wireless, and then you say, oh, this is slow. I should be doing this on my 1 gig NIC. In the past, you would have to cancel the copy, dock the machine, then start the copy again. With multi-channel, you simply dock while the copy is ongoing. The 1 gig NIC arrives at the system. We listen to it, say, oh, new interface, let's recalculate things. Oh, this is much better than that other one. Can I connect? I try to connect. Yes, I connect. I drop the other one. And then we naturally, you see wireless speed, 1 gig. In fact, a demo that we like to do a lot is we have a machine configured with a few 1 gigs, a few 10 gigs, a few 54 gig NICs. Yes, there are those. And we start with the cables disconnected, and we just start a workload and start putting cables in and watching the bandwidth go up. right? That's a fun thing we did at the Storage Developers Conference. All right. So what do you do? This is a summary of what you should be doing. So first thing, if you don't have the RSS capability in your NIC, then for one NIC, there's nothing we can do. So there's only one connection. That's it. If you have multiple, we'll put one connection per, right? And we recommend that you team so you get fault tolerance for non-SMB workloads. So the best configuration, if you have multiple non-RSS, non-RDMA NICs, team multi-channel on top. If you have RSS-capable NICs, we also suggest that you do it. If you have just one NIC, there's no real good reason to do teaming. But if you have multiple NICs that are RSS-capable, you can team and put multi-channel on top, and you have the best behavior. Okay? The failure actually occurs faster when you're doing teaming, by the way. So that's another reason to do teaming, right? The last situation, the last two rows, is RDMA-capable NICs. So as we described, RDMA-capable NICs, some of them that are not Ethernet-based cannot be teamed at all. And the Ethernet-based ones, when they are teamed, you lose the capability to do RDMA. Because by definition, when you're doing RDMA, if you saw the talk yesterday about RDMA, we have to actually talk straight up to the NIC to do memory registration, to do all kinds of fun things before we do transfers. And if you team, it becomes a virtual NIC. I say, where's the NIC? I can't find it because it's hidden behind the layer of software. So we, if you want to use the RDMA capability of a NIC, do not team that NIC. Let multi-channel use it. Jose, what if I have all these things and I want to use RDMA and I want to use something else and I want to use fault tolerance? Then the most likely configuration you have is two RDMA-capable NICs, two non-RDMA-capable NICs, the two non-RDMA-capable NICs you team, the two RDMA-capable NICs you do not team. And SMB will naturally prefer the RDMA path. Okay? Or paths. How do you troubleshoot this? Well, you can look things up in Server Manager, but I do highly recommend that you do PowerShell. Some of these capabilities are actually only available through PowerShell. The rule of thumb for multi-channel is if it's not broken, don't touch it, right? It should just work by default. Configure networks properly. Look at the configuration. It should just be working. If it's not working, we have some tools to troubleshoot it. And I actually want to show a screenshot here. So this is my live system. I have a file server, which is the same setup that Bob was using. So I have a client that's running Hyper-V, and I have a server that's a failover cluster. We have a file server. I have a few 10 gig NICs, a few RDMA NICs, and a 1 gig NIC that I'm using for management. And these are some of the details. So let me show you a few things. So first of all, right in the top there, sorry, let me find it. So, okay, so the top one there is the Get SMB Server Network interface. So what you see there is SMB will list all the interfaces that are used for a specific cluster scope. So notice that I filter by scope name. Notice also that I'm running this command from the client and I'm using sim session to target the server. So I'm remoting into the server to get that list, right? Also notice how we know if the NIC is RSS capable or RDMA capable. This is an SMB commandlet. SMB is actually asking the network stack for the capabilities of the NIC to understand that. The second link that is the client view of things. So on the client side, I'm querying for interfaces. So this client, in addition to the server has a 1 gig and 2 RDMA, the client there has a 1 gig, 2 RDMA, and 2 10 gig, which are the ones that Bob teamed, right? Now they're unteamed. If they were teamed, you would see just the team there, right? And then the bottom part here is the multi-channel connection. So this is kind of giving you the idea of how multi-channel makes the decision, right? If you do a Get SMB multi-channel connection, it's telling me that there are two paths. So that means that I'm using dual connections. I'm actually doing multiple on the same time. And if you go deeper there and look at that properties, you see that we're doing two per interface. But notice how it knows if the client is RDMA capable, if the server is RDMA capable, what's the client IP, what's the server IP. So SMB, the client, is actually doing a lot of interesting calculations to see, okay, so what is the best way that I could get to the other side? What are the best paths, right? And we do that automatically. The bottom one, I use the switch that is not default, is the dash include not selected. And that shows all the paths that we considered, that but not necessarily selected, right? So you see there's the 1 gig path there. And you see also that for every RDMA interface, I consider going RDMA, and I also consider going TCP. Because there's an odd chance that I have an InfiniBand interface here that routes up to a TCP outside of InfiniBand and then goes down to the other side. So although both sides are InfiniBand, I can't actually do RDMA between the two because there's a switch in the middle. Not an InfiniBand switch, I should say a router in the middle. Right? So if you go outside of RDMA and then down the other end, only iWarp RDMA can do that. So out of the 3 different RDMA technologies, only one can cross TCP/IP routers. But the short story that I'm trying to get to you here is there is intelligence in the SMB client. And notice that it queries the server for information as well. Okay? Since I am in demo mode anyway, so let me show you a little bit of the workload that I'm doing. So here I have my Hyper-V box, and it's doing Hyper-V over SMB. How can I tell? Very simple. I just go look at my VHD configuration. You see the VHD is on a UNC path. That's how I know I'm using SMB. Jose, how do I know that I'm using multi-channel? Well, you should just assume that you are. If you really want to be sure, you go to PowerShell and you say, get SMB multi-channel connection. If there's more than one line, you're doing multi-channel. Okay? And then inside there, I'm doing a simulation. I'm going to start something. You're familiar with SQL.io? It's just a SQL simulator. And I'm reading and writing data there. I'm going to pull a performance monitor here. And you see a couple of things are going on here. So first of all, the performance on this specific setup, I will eventually get there. All right, that's what I want to show you. So on one side here, you see the raw data bytes per second. So I'm doing close to 2.4 gigabytes a second. This is actually a cluster-in-a-box file server using one of the LSI HADAS interfaces. I believe we're doing 10 SSDs to achieve that performance, and we're limited by the capacity of the controller in that case. In fact, SMB could do much better than this because we're doing dual 54 gig NICs in that setup, so we have bandwidth to spare. But what I have on the other side here is that I have 2 NICs, right? And on this side, if I go here, you can see that I'm using one adapter, the other adapter. And I'm load balancing between the two. You see that? One adapter, the other adapter, right? So what I'm going to do to show the failover, it's kind of hard to showcase here, but I'm going to do this. I'm going to go over here, and I have 2 RDMA interfaces. I'm going to go ahead and disable one of them. So what you're going to see is one of my NICs got dropped. See? Now the other one is picking up all the work. I did that yesterday on another configuration where I was doing, were you there in the RDMA session? So on that session, we were doing, I believe it was about 8 gigabytes a second. So in that case, I actually needed the 254 gig interfaces to actually achieve that throughput. When I disable one of them, I drop from 8 to about 6, which is what one leg of 54 gig can do for me. Now, it actually was degraded a bit. Here, what you see is that there's pretty much no change in the overall throughput because 54 gig can handle 2.5 gigabytes a second just fine, right? What happens if I disable the other RDMA? Well, no good thing will come after that. You will drop to the 1 gig interface, which can do what? 110 megabytes a second. That's not a good day in the office, but it will survive that too. But what I wanted to do, instead of disabling the second one, is re-enabling the one I disabled. And it's a little bit harder to see because what we're doing here, as soon as the second interface arrives, we pick that up and we stop using just the one and we go back to using two. Now, my performance counter for the other NIC went away. Not sure if you noticed, right? If you have two and the instance goes away, I lost that instance. So in order to see that, you can only see that the one went down. I would actually have to add that back. If you look at this guy here, this guy is no longer a good instance, right? So I have to delete that and re-add, because I know there's some folks that say, you're cheating, you're not really doing it. No, I am. I'm going to add here, and what I'm counting here is inbound frames per second. I'm going to edit, say OK, and I'm going to rescale. There you go. One, the other one. One, the other one. Jose, what's that dip? Oh, that dip is when you add the counter, it kind of resets the thing. It's not a real dip. You see the performance on the other end never changed. It's just a glitch in the network, the performance monitor infrastructure. But that was my demo there. I'm not sure if you got all the details, but what we're trying to do here is just give you a little flavor for what kind of things we're talking about. And multi-channel can do a lot of interesting things, and I've seen people that come to me with all kinds of weird questions, like I have. We're talking here about the guy that had 8 NICs, right? 8 1-gig NICs, and they wanted to kind of team 4 and then put the other 4 in a multi-channel set and how you do that. We had so many of these requests. We actually have a command called SMB multi-channel constraints, which is not well known. I actually updated the PowerShell reference yesterday to include that. That's new in the release candidate. Now, the default setting is good. If you can live with the default setting, please don't touch it. But if you want to say, I want this server to actually go through these NICs, you now have a command that you do new SMB multi-channel constraints, server name blah, dash interface ID, let's say 2013, and you can tell multi-channel to only use these NICs for this server. I highly advise against doing that because you're turning off all the multi-channel intelligence and you're thinking you can do better than multi-channel in discovering things, which usually is okay. The only problem is later in life, someone is going to add a faster NIC. Someone is going to disable that NIC or do something else, and then you're forcing that setup, and you might actually shoot yourself in the foot. So leave the default configuration if you can. If you choose to customize that and do, like specific hints to multi-channel, make sure you update that hint every time you change the networking configuration, because we will store that in the registry, and it will be used instead of our regular policies, okay? All right, that was about it. I have one more comment, which is multi-channel is only used for SMB, but there are other workloads that are now doing SMB. So Hyper-V over SMB relates to this. SQL over SMB relates to this. And shared nothing live migration relates to this, interestingly enough. Another thing that you see is CSV redirection traffic also uses SMB. Not sure if you noticed that, but when you have multiple CSV nodes in a cluster talking to each other doing redirection, they actually leverage SMB, and they also use multi-channel, and they also use RDMA. So this is all integrated. We work hard with the cluster team to make sure that that happens. Question? With the what? Oh, how does SMB deal with the routing table? It's actually a very interesting question. In the old days, we actually used a function that would be like get the best path when we're trying to calculate the other side. Now we work with the networking team. Essentially, we actually ask the network to create the pairs for us. So there's a function call in Windows called get sorted address pairs. Not sure if you saw that. But there's a way that you can actually go to the network infrastructure and say, okay, I have these addresses and I want you to get to these addresses. Can you give me a list based on the routing table? So SMB doesn't do it. It asks the networking stack to do it and it uses the routing table to do that. But that's how we handle situations like, for instance, you have one NIC on the client, two on the server. What's the best way to do it? It's two connections, one to each side on the server, right? You have two connections on the client, one on the server. Maybe the server has a team, right? So you do what? One from each to the same one here. You have two here, three here. What do you do? So we do all these kinds of calculations. If you want to have fun, create two VMs, put like five switches, and then start creating different configurations between two VMs, and then try to trip multi-channel. Let me know what you find. Like put everyone on the same subnet, different subnets, something that doesn't connect in the middle. Like you have three here, two here, but this one actually never gets to this one. It's routed differently. Try to trip it up and see what you achieve. Okay? And we're very interested right now in these kinds of interactions because networking can be hard, right? If you have lots of NICs, lots of switches, LBFO on top of RDMA with SRLV and all TLAs that you can throw at some problem, right? So it gets quite interesting, right? So let us know what you find. And we're very proud of the work we did in multi-channel. We worked together with the networking team to make sure it works well with teaming, with RDMA, and other teams like Cluster, Hyper-V, and SQL. All right? Any other questions? Yes? Public network, yeah. That's a great question. So the question is essentially, let's say I have a scenario where I have a cluster with CSV, and I want to use multi-channel, but there are private networks, public networks, how does it behave? So essentially, the cluster team programs us to do the right thing. So if you notice that when I was doing the troubleshooting, there's this thing called scopes in cluster. So you actually assign scopes to the NetFT, the fault-tolerant net adapter that cluster uses. So cluster has some logic that says, okay, so if you want to use the cluster networks, right? So it creates a NetFT, and then it puts in the scope of the NetFT, it puts all the NICs that you have tagged as being the cluster network. And then we'll multi-channel only within those, right? And hopefully you do some RDMA there, so we can do RDMA on top of multi-channel. It could be multiple paths, all that. Now, let's say you lose all of your cluster networks. Then at that point, they say, okay, all I have is the mixed ones, right? So you can set a NIC to be both public and private. So it would start using those as well, because it's best to use that instead of failing altogether, right? So there's a lot of logic in cluster now. You will find a special scope in get SMB multi-channel, get SMB server multi-network interface that will list all the scopes. You see one scope that's kind of weird. It's an IPv6 private address that starts with FE80. That's the NetFT scope that cluster programs for us so that we can get information from cluster about what networks are important. So by all means, configure cluster properly with all the right public and cluster networks. Make sure you got the right thing. Cluster will pass that information on to multi-channel, and we and the SMB client will work accordingly. Okay? Higher throughput as well. So if you have multiple CSV, if you have multiple cluster networks that are available, we will multi-channel across those. If they are RDMA, we'll use RDMA on those, right? So absolutely. The coolest cluster we have over there, so you know about the 64-node clusters, right? So there's a cluster in our building over there in 42, where the guys actually configure a 64-node cluster, all of them with RDMA interfaces, and they do all kinds of weird, unnatural things to that cluster. Yeah, it's fun. And they do that, and they test. They have multiple paths. Because these network interfaces, they typically have two ports anyway, right? Some of the RDMA cards have four ports. So you can do like two ports going out, two ports going in. And that's usually what you should think about, right? So you have dual paths, one path that's internal, and it could take you to the storage, and another path that goes out. And if you need fault tolerance, you need to have two on each side. There's this idea of maybe having all in one big network, which is also possible, and you route that up. So there's a lot of conversations going on about how to best configure this. Yeah, so there's a comment here about the fact that I'm way past my time, right? Just a little bit more. So there's a comment here about the fact that do you need multiple subnets or can you do single subnets? So if you're not using cluster, SMB multichannel is fully capable of using multiple addresses on the same subnet. But if you're doing clusters, when you create a cluster IP address for a resource, and if you have only one subnet, cluster won't put more than one IP in that subnet, even if you have multiple interfaces. So with clustering, you want to have separate subnets. So they show up in cluster as separate networks, and then you can put the multiple IP addresses. Actually, we started doing only multi-subnet, and then some folks in standalone configuration say, hey, come on, I have multiple addresses here. Can't you handle it? And we did that last. We kind of started with cluster in mind, honestly. Yeah. That's all. You want to make everything highly available. All right, thanks. We're past our time. Thank you.